Good evening and welcome to the local news. Today is Thursday, August 22nd. I'm Lisa Music reporting for KMUD. In tonight's news, San Francisco's homeless transport to Humboldt spurs supervisor's letter, Humboldt County OES prepares for emergencies, and rain and possible thunderstorms in the forecast. Stay tuned. News on those stories and more coming right up. With cloudy skies and rain already impacting parts of the North Coast, KMUD News turns to our partners at the Eureka Office of the National Weather Service for the latest forecast.
Hi, this is Sahaya Velez. I'm a meteorologist at the National Weather Service, Eureka. So right now we have a frontal system that is moving through the area. We have been observing some light showers for the North Coast this afternoon. So far we have been observing less than 1,500 inches right now for the coastal area. And this is expected to continue through this evening. We have a wet storm that is right now off Oregon and Washington coast. This is expected to continue digging southward and approach the area tonight through Friday. So this will bring an increasing precipitation over the area. So it will be mostly during the day on Friday over the northern portion. These include Humboldt, Del Norte, and western portion of Trinity. And then during the afternoon Friday, these showers will start to spread east and southward throughout the rest of the day.
The anticipated light showers with moderate to locally heavy rainfall have the potential to be accompanied by isolated thunderstorms Friday afternoon and evening. Rainfall amounts will vary across the forecast area.
So far, we are expecting for this rainfall total amounts for Friday, it will range from 3/10 of an inch to 9/10 of an inch is possible for the coastal area. Localized highest amount over the interior, highest terrain. And for southern portion, it will be a less amount from few hundreds up to a quarter of an inch expected for Friday. Then we are going to see the storm moving over the area. Friday night to Saturday, this is going to promote a diminishing in showers over the area with lingering showers into Saturday. And after that Saturday, we're going to see dry air starting to move in from the northwest, drying conditions. Temperature will continue to be below normal. We might see for the interior chilly temperature Friday morning, Saturday morning as well with this system.
Earlier forecast maps showed the coastal areas just north of Eureka receiving the highest rainfall totals, up to 2 inches. However, that has changed.
Models have been trending a little bit lower, but the highest amount will be, north of, I would say Cape Mendocino, but mainly over the southwest facing higher terrain.
The rainfall and cooler temps will last for only a short while before summer temps return to the North Coast.
And then Sunday into early next week, we are going to have a high pressure building over the area and bringing back dry and hot temperatures early next week with temperature over the interior in the upper 90s to 105 degrees possible.
To access the latest weather forecast for the Redwood Community Radio broadcast area, check out our new weather page on our website at kmud.org. Click on the news drop-down menu, then click weather. The most recent Humboldt County Board of Supervisors meeting included a presentation on this year's count of homeless residents. And with the count topping 1,500, supervisors are concerned that a San Francisco relocation program is adding to it. Daniel Mintz reports.
Humboldt County supervisors are concerned that San Francisco's changes to its homeless transportation program are sending people to Humboldt without means of employment or support. Attention to the issue follows media reports on San Francisco's Journey Home program, which provides bus vouchers and other assistance to homeless people who want to travel elsewhere. The San Francisco Standard online news outlet has reported Humboldt is among the top three most common destinations, and that prompted the drafting of a letter to San Francisco Mayor London Breed, asking her to, quote, ensure that Journey Home participants have the support they need to obtain housing and employment before they receive transportation assistance to Humboldt County. The letter was on the August 20th supervisors' meeting agenda. Board Chair Rex Bone said San Francisco has removed much of the Journey Home program's criteria for having support at the destinations. He's concerned Humboldt will bear a disproportionate share of responsibility.
Our cost for taking care of a homeless person that has nothing up here, we saw the stats, you know, and it's expensive. And if we're ever going to go the other way, we've got to have them, this has to curtail so we can take care of our own homeless that, you know, so we can do all homeless, but we don't need to be a dumping ground. I don't mean dumping ground. I just think you guys have enough to do already, right?
But supervisors Natalie Arroyo and Mike Wilson said the letter's tone is too sharp and staff-to-staff communication should be tried first. Humboldt Health and Human Services Director Connie Beck said there are indeed concerns about San Francisco's program, but after the discussion, she nodded to collaboration.
I see the Health and Human Services Director for San Francisco on a regular basis, monthly or maybe every other month. So I can definitely have a conversation with him. My takeaway from all of the media that I've read and even the policy, they changed their program based on direction from their council, from the city of San Francisco. And so that's when I first started hearing about this, that's why I reached out to you all and said, if you have connections with people in San Francisco, please have a conversation with them. Because we want to be partners in this issue. We don't want to, you know, PRA and be San Francisco's problem. We want to help with this issue.
Supervisor Michelle Bushnell's district includes Southern Humboldt, and she said the issue is of concern to residents there, including homeless residents.
I've heard about this in the last 2 weeks a lot, and a lot of concern, and a lot of concern about what are we going to do? We can't even take care of our own. We can't even shelter our own. And so the community, and I don't know about the rest of the supervisors, but the community, especially in the Southern Humboldt area where services are very limited, is very concerned. And also, ironically enough, one of the houseless folks said to me, I'm scared. I don't, you know, they have their own community and they're comfortable within their communities. And oftentimes that's why they don't want to relocate, because they don't know anybody in Eureka and they have familiarity in their own houseless community. And it scares them as well, thinking that other folks are they going to disrupt? And so it's, you know, it's concerning.
Supervisors unanimously voted to have Beck work with Bone on reworking the letter to make it more friendly. Discussion on the letter was in the context of a presentation on the 2024 point-in-time count of homeless people in the county. On the night of January 22nd of this year, 1,573 homeless people were counted, which is a 4.4% decrease since the last count in 2022. And a 7.6% decrease since 2019. The count is likely an underestimate, as many more people than counted are believed to be in locations that aren't accessible. In Eureka for KMUD News, this is Daniel Mintz.
Just before news time, the Humboldt County Sheriff's Office of Emergency Services completed its 2024 Coastal Region Radio Exercise, the first of its kind. This functional exercise was designed to test the policies, procedures, and protocols of local and regional emergency management and communication systems. The goal was to build resiliency among community partners and test the interoperability of communication plans, particularly between local OES staff and auxiliary communication groups who typically have limited opportunities to practice together. The exercise took place both locally and regionally, involving participants from various tribal, federal, state, and local agencies, as well as NGOs, FBOs, and CBOs across different levels. The scenario simulated a major earthquake off the coast of California, where participants imagined that all cell phone and internet communications were disabled. Emergency operations centers in the regional coast acted as if they had been activated, with local auxiliary communications requested to assist with field reports and mutual aid requests. Participants took on roles such as controllers, evaluators, observers, and players, each with specific responsibilities during the exercise. The planning committee included multiple counties from both coastal and inland regions, along with local Humboldt County groups such as the Community Emergency Response Team, CERT, the Southern Humboldt Emergency Preparedness Team, SHEPT, and the Humboldt Amateur Radio Club, HARC. KMUD's Lauren Schmidt, a graduate of the Community Emergency Preparedness Academy and a licensed ham radio operator, assisted in the preparations for today's exercise. After completing her primary duties, she conducted this interview from the OES bunker in Eureka.
I'm David Boyd, and I'm part of the Humboldt OXCOM team. We're volunteers with the Office of Emergency Services to help with auxiliary communication in time of emergency. During an emergency, communication is so important to get reports of the field situation, what needs are out there, and to coordinate resources and to get the help where it's supposed to be. In a large emergency, such as maybe a major event on the Cascadia subduction zone, conventional communications may be impacted. We may not have cell phones or landlines for telephones. We may not have internet or SMS text services. But when all those go down, amateur radio still works. And OXCOM is focusing on harnessing, training, and using amateur radio to help with emergency communications in time of need.
Can you just shed a little light on how folks from different CERTs, different fire departments, police stations, and OES are training and working behind the scenes prior to an emergency?
Yes, you can't just jump into emergency communications at the time of an emergency. It takes a lot of skill and training and equipment and practice for it to work properly. And so we have plenty of people that are part of emergency preparedness teams, such as CERT teams throughout the county, or unaffiliated volunteers that work in ham radio that work together to develop those skills. For the ham operators, a lot of that happens through public service during the course of the year. I'm also a member of the Humboldt Amateur Radio Club, known as HARC. And we do about 10 or 12 public service events a year, providing radio support to things like the Kinetic Sculpture Race, the Tour of the Unknown Coast, Avenue of the Giants Marathon, things like that, where cell communication may be sketchy, and we use radios to help keep track of the participants and protect their safety. And so that's one way we develop skills. The CERT teams also train and drill. They all have different capabilities. Some use the FRS, GMRS, kind of walkie-talkies you might buy at Costco, that they're low power, don't require a license. They don't go very far, but they're useful in a neighborhood or community. Others have their ham license, a tech license or higher, that can use the amateur radio bands. And again, we test regularly. We have a big drill coming up on August 22nd. We're going to be testing all of our local emergency capabilities.
Before, I want to dive deeper into that, but before that, can you explain to folks what ham is, if they're not familiar, and why it's critical? You know, at one point it might have been considered antiquated, but we're now realizing it's actually critical during a crisis when communications are down.
Well, there are different radio bands that are regulated by the Federal Communications Commission for different purposes. We're familiar with the commercial radio bands, such as AM or FM radio, and there's what we call shortwave radio. Within that are the amateur bands, a certain set of frequencies that are allocated for amateur radio use. And to use those frequencies, you have to have a license. That license involves taking a test and then passing the test and getting a license. There are different levels of licenses, which have increasing levels of privileges, which means more frequencies that you can operate on.
How are hams able to still communicate when systems are down?
Well, most hams have backup power supplies, because one of the purposes of the amateur radio band is for use in time of emergency. You know, in parts of the country, hurricanes or tornadoes, here earthquakes or fires. It's very important to be able to maintain those communications. Many hams have batteries, sometimes solar powered.
KL6RKM clear on 73 to everyone.
Mid interview, a local ham was checking in.
73 John, this is KA6 OES at the OES bunkers, standing by.
Today has been a preparation for an upcoming drill. Who have we been able to contact today?
We've been contacting CERT teams and the Humboldt Amateur Radio Club in various locations in the county. We've contacted Ferndale and McKinleyville, various locations in Eureka, and down into Southern Humboldt.
Yeah,
Myers Flat, I think.
And Garberville Fire.
And Garberville Fire, yeah.
And this is making sure everything's good to go for an upcoming training. You know, what is this training? Why is it so important? And how is it unique from other trainings?
Well, it's an exercise that we're training for the exercise. And the exercise is going to be a test of emergency communications equipment and procedures involving all 16 coastal counties in OES Region 2. Those are the counties that go up and down the coast of California. In case of a major event, say a Cascadia subduction zone earthquake, their counties may be impacted and need resources from other counties. That's called mutual aid. And we're going to be testing using amateur radio and other radio methods for doing mutual aid requests. The information to inform those requests is going to be collected locally using local networks of preparedness organizations and other operational area partners to send reports into their local county OES offices, who will compile them, figure out what's needed, and then put those requests out to other counties.
Why are exercises like this so important?
Because we have to develop the processes and procedures and skills. We can't wait till an event happens and then try to figure things out, because it'll never happen at that point. And it takes some muscle memory and some troubleshooting. Even for those that have been in the radio field for a while, some of these things take some working out to make sure the systems work properly. So we do these exercises not to just pat ourselves on the back because everything works right, but to find out what doesn't work. And the more things that don't work, the better, because then we have things to work on to improve.
Absolutely. What would you say to folks that are considering getting involved, or maybe they're not considering getting involved, but as we're seeing, you know, in such a rural county where resources, official government resources are limited, volunteers are absolutely critical.
Well, I think it's important in our area to prepare for emergencies. It's not a case of if an earthquake is going to happen, but when, because it will happen, and fires happen and other things, floods can happen. And so we encourage everybody to be prepared for emergencies. That includes having at least a 72-hour go bag in their home, probably longer in our area, and a way to communicate with people. You want to communicate with your loved ones, you want to communicate with first responders, and amateur radio can be a way to do that.
We were discussing earlier that there's kind of a generational gap between ham operators and some of the emergency officials. So what would you say to the younger generation, maybe words of inspiration for them to get involved?
Well, we take our technology for granted, but it's way more fragile than you would think. It doesn't take much for cell service to go down. I remember during the public safety power shutoffs a couple years ago, in my neighborhood we had no cell service for a couple days. Internet can go down easily. It can be just a breakdown or some kind of malware or something can cause that. So don't take communications lightly. They're important. And if you want to have another tool for your survival, just like you might take a first aid class or a CPR class or have your go bag, have some alternative communication skills. It may save your life. It may save your neighbors.
Anything else people should know?
It's fun. It's a good skill. It's a great community of people. And it's not just planning for emergencies. You can use it to assist with public service. You can volunteer and help with many events, like, you know, like the races or parades. People here help with the rhododendron parade and the Christmas truckers parade and things like that. And it's a way to get out. I get out and do things I would not otherwise do because of the service. So it's great to get out of the house and in beautiful places and practice a skill that I enjoy honing. So you can find fun in this as well. So there are many aspects to the hobby, as well as the fact it's of great use in times of emergency.
So folks probably know me from KMOD Radio, but I'm actually a licensed TAM, KM6RSA, and today I've been practicing. How did I do?
You did wonderful. You're great. You're ready to go in case of an emergency.
HARC will be holding a ham radio technician license class starting September 9th, which prepares students for the amateur radio technician class license examination. The class is free of charge and open to all members of the community. The class will be offered via Zoom, meeting for 10 Mondays from 7 to 9 p.m., beginning Monday, September 9th, and concluding on November 11th. The course will introduce radio and electronic fundamentals, tips on operating station equipment, procedures for communicating with other hams, licensing and operating regulations, and radio safety. More information can be found on the Humboldt Amateur Radio Club website at www.humboldt-arc.org. In state news, California Governor Gavin Newsom signed new legislation into law, which he says will help to stop retail crime in the state. Pacifica Radio's Chloe Behrens reports.
The 10-bill package that Governor Newsom signed targets organized crime rings responsible for repeated shoplifting and addresses crimes such as car break-ins and cargo theft. The bills were drafted through a collaborative effort between state and law enforcement officials, along with California workers and retailers. California Assembly Member Mark Berman says the teamwork reflects an increasing concern about the sharp rise of retail crime across the state.
We all came together as a team to try to draft thoughtful policies to address the retail theft and crime surge that we have in California. In recent years, the Bay Area has experienced the largest increase in shoplifting rates in California. San Mateo County, which is one of the counties that I represent, saw shoplifting rates increase 53% between 2019 and 2022. But this isn't just happening in the Bay Area. The rise in retail theft and crime is a growing issue throughout California.
Democratic lawmakers hope the new laws will provide voters with an alternative to passing Proposition 36, a tough-on-crime ballot measure, this November. If passed, Prop 36 will increase penalties for certain drug and theft crimes and will roll back elements of Prop 47. That's the measure enacted 10 years ago, which sought to decrease the California prison population by reclassifying some nonviolent crimes from felonies to misdemeanors. California Senator Nancy Skinner says the new bills will tackle the major roots of property crime in the state without undoing the benefits of Prop 47.
What we're talking about is well-organized, large operations, not petty thieves. And in the state Senate, we know that organized retail theft affects every community in California and every kind of business. We know that retail theft has consequences, big and small, physical and financial. And we know we have to take the right steps in order to stop it without returning to the days of mass incarceration.
Democrats are split on Prop 36, and some see this bill package as a way to divert funding from the Yes on 36 campaign. Earlier this year, Governor Newsom tried to introduce a competing ballot measure to Prop 36 that would have addressed some complaints against Prop 47 without scrapping the law entirely. The governor abandoned that effort after receiving pushback from Republicans, law enforcement, and some members of his own party. Newsom is still opposed to Prop 36 and says the ballot measure would return the state to an era of overcrowded prisons full of people charged with low-level crimes and those suffering from untreated behavioral health issues.
Prop 36 takes us back to the 1980s, the war on drugs, mass incarceration. It promotes a promise that can't be delivered. That initiative has nothing to do with retail theft. I would ask those that support it, particularly mayors, where are the treatment slots? Where are the beds? There are 22 counties in the state of California. This is not a local initiative, Prop 36. It's a statewide initiative. 22 counties don't have one residential treatment facility.
Governor Newsom says this new slate of bills will address the needs of retailers and consumers that were not specified in existing laws like Prop 47. He says California is setting a nationwide precedent by signing these bills into law.
California has been providing, despite what I read and hear often, a national model in this space in terms of actually trying to address these issues that are universal all across the United States of America. You wouldn't know that based upon some commentary. You'd think they were unique here. What is, though, unique here, I think, is the approach we're taking to get serious about these issues.
Since 2019, the state of California has invested $1.1 billion towards resources targeting retail theft. Governor Newsom says signing these bills is the beginning of a process, and they are working on more bills to address specific issues related to retail theft. I'm Chloe Behrens, Pacifica Radio, KPFA.
In national news, hundreds of immigrant rights activists completed a three-day, 48-mile walk, a feat they hope will raise awareness of the plight of undocumented immigrants and the need for the country to offer a path to citizenship. KPFA's Scott Baba brings you the details.
Members of the Northern California Coalition for Immigration Reform, in collaboration with 20 organizations and pro-immigrant rights groups, led roughly 200 people on a multi-day walk from San Jose to San Francisco. Organizers of the walk say they wanted to use the walk to convey a clear message for the presidential candidates of both major parties: the need for a path to citizenship for undocumented immigrants. Elizabeth Rodriguez is a spokesperson for the Coalition for Humane Immigrant Rights, or CHURLA. She took part in the walk.
The walk, it started in San Jose, and it was meant to represent the 40 miles that we're walking by foot. We really are putting our bodies in line, and the 40 miles are just as a form to symbolize the 40 years of inaction since any kind of action has been taken on immigration.
Rodriguez said that while the United States has taken some steps to help undocumented immigrants who want to become contributing members of society, it has not done nearly enough.
So far we've had things like TPS and DACA, which helps a lot of folks, but it's not a path to citizenship. It doesn't give them legalization, it doesn't give them citizenship, it doesn't give them residency, it just allows them to work, and that's still not enough. It's not a concrete thing. It doesn't really give benefits. It's always under attack. It's unstable. DACA can always be taken away. And we really need to help those who have been here, who have contributed to this country, have given their entire lives, who have families, who contribute to the economy. And that is the reason why we're marching here today.
She said that they timed the march to coincide the conclusion of the three-day walk with the beginning of the Democratic National Convention.
Kamala Harris is hoping to be the Democratic nominee. She is there to accept the nomination for the Democratic Party, and she really wants our support. She really wants our vote. She really has to commit to the immigration community, and the best way that she can do that is to commit and support the immigrant community, but also commit to updating the registry. The registry is a bill that has already existed since 1929, and it is the most progressive way, the most inclusive way that people can gain their citizenship. And today, out of all days, she really needs to commit and protect immigrants from across the country who really, really contribute a lot to this great nation.
The walk started Saturday in San Jose's Plaza Herencia Mexicana and finished on the steps of San Francisco's City Hall. I'm Scott Baba, Pacifica Radio, KPFA.
That's all for tonight's broadcast. Thank you for listening. Thanks to our engineer, Dennis Marr. And thanks to our reporters, Lauren Schmidt, Daniel Mintz, Chloe Behrens, and Scott Baba. Reporting from the KMUD studio in Redway, I'm Lisa Music.